Hello, everybody, and Tom here, and I'm joined with the esteemed Timothy Sean Quinn of Xavier. Well, you're an emeritus now, but Xavier University. And we've been talking a lot about technology, but we're going to go a little bit further back because most of the people on whom we've been focusing have been contemporary critics like are relatively contemporary critics of technology, such as Jacques Ellul or Gunther Anders, Ivan Illich. But we can push it ourselves a little back into, and this is sort of why we have Dr. Quinn with us here today, the root, the origins of modernity itself. And we've alluded to that problematic, but we haven't really unpacked it. And a lot of times the name Descartes comes up in connection with the concerns about science and modernity and so forth, but he's almost just doing a bit of a tidying job, Descartes is, because he has two important predecessors, Bacon and Machiavelli, and so we can ask Dr. Quinn, who's read these books with a certain thoroughness, if you might want to sort of sketch the problems of how these figures and related figures frame the science and even lend to science a kind of political inflection, which is not, in my mind, adequately appreciated in contemporary discourse. This is an opening question there, so.
So your opening question is for me to sketch the background of early modern science?
I guess it's a bit broad, right? Yeah.
Well, I could tell you what I've been thinking and why I moved here, and we could begin there. And you interrupt me with questions as I blather on here. Sure. Given... where to start? I was always persuaded somewhat by some modern or contemporary critiques of technology, you know. But beginning with Heidegger in a way, but also other authors. You mentioned Illich and Gunther Anders. I'm unfamiliar with, but Hannah Arendt in The Human Condition, for example, makes very interesting.
Her first husband.
Yes, yeah. Very interesting comments about modernity and technology. And so the more I thought about that problem, the more I wanted to get to the root of the problem. But the root of the problem precedes modernity, or at least precedes the 20th century and the 19th century. It's often the case that I've heard this said, that it's really beginning with the Industrial Revolution that you have this technological explosion, but the theory of technology develops centuries before. And it's a response to certain very specific moves away from both Christian medieval philosophy and ancient philosophy, ancient Socratic philosophy, namely Platonic Aristotelian philosophy. There's another leg to the ancient school, Epicurus, Lucretius, the early moderns, I'll probably talk about in a minute, end up appropriating. So it's not a wholesale rejection of the ancient qua ancient. It's a rejection of a particular strain, and perhaps the dominant strain in ancient philosophy, the Platonic Aristotelian strain, for reasons that we'll get to.
And there is an effort to appropriate this third sort of strain.
Oh, yes.
For example, Marx, for example, as I recall, did a lot of his early work.
Yeah, he did.
With Lucretius.
Yes, it was Lucretius. Yeah.
And makes active use of him in some of his theorization. Mm-hmm. So that's a little bit, it's like, a little bit further down the line, but. Anyway, I don't mean to interrupt you, but go on.
That's okay. So I had been teaching for decades Descartes' Discourse on Method. In the Discourse on Method, in the sixth part, culminates in an assertion of science on behalf of technology, right? The And he frames, you know, that assertion in a very, very significant way as a stand against the prevailing ecclesiastical authority. He begins part six of the discourse saying, you know, I had just finished the treatise containing all these things. It's the things he summarizes in part five, his physics, basically. It was to be published in a book called Le Monde. And he writes, when I learned that people to whom I defer and whose authority over my actions cannot be less than that of my reason over my thoughts had disapproved of a certain opinion in the realm of physics published a short while before by someone else. Okay, now this is an extraordinarily coy reminder of an event that had scandalized the intellectual community of Europe and was known almost instantly around Europe. That, of course, the someone else is Galileo. So the people to whom he defers is the Inquisition, the Holy Office, the Church. Descartes, commenting on the trial, says, I don't wish to say I was in agreement with Galileo, but that I found nothing in it that I found prejudicial either to religion or to the state, or that would have prevented me from writing it had my reason persuaded me of it. That last phrase looks back to something he said in the previous sentence, that the Inquisition's authority over his actions cannot be less than that of his reason over his thoughts. On the surface, that sounds like he's offering complete deference to the Inquisition, and he's not. That's not what it says. It says the Inquisition has authority over his actions. His reason has authority over his thoughts. He's going to think what he damn well pleases, and he pleases to think that Galileo is right. That's why he would have written it had reason persuaded him of it. Had reason persuaded him? Yes. We know this in two ways. In part six of the discourse, he tells us, well, I decided to withdraw my work from publication in case they found some errors in it of which I had hitherto been unaware. Okay, that suggests agreement with Galileo, with Galileo's physics. But more directly, in a private letter to his friend Mersenne, he expresses shock at the trial of Galileo and says, frankly, if Galileo is wrong, the entire foundation of my philosophy is wrong. That's a pretty bald assertion of agreement, okay? So that's the first moment. The new science, the science that is developing in modernity, you know, or in the 17th century, that can trace its origins to Galileo from Descartes' point of view, is under siege, under attack by the church. And so he decides to withdraw his own works from publication because he doesn't want to suffer Galileo's fate. But then he says in the following paragraph, but beginning to notice, all the accuracy of this new science. And he said, beginning to test it on various specific difficulties, I saw how far it could take us. He said, I realized I could not keep it hidden without gravely sinning against the law that obliges us to procure as best we can the common good of humanity. The fact that the accent is on humanity, I think, is important. This is not just a national endeavor, even though Descartes writes the book in French, the vernacular, unusual in those days, rather than in Latin. Nonetheless, the object, the ultimate audience for the book isn't the French, it's humanity at large, and it seeks to bring about their common good. Now, I always ask my students in the past, I said, how many of you have taken physics? And, you know, several will raise their hands. And I'll say, how many of you got to the chapter in the book that talks about the common good? And of course, what follows is laughter. But, you know, so it's from a certain point of view, not an obvious connection between physics and the common good. However, Descartes identifies what that good is, and he calls it mastery and possession of nature, which is meant to, he says, in place of the speculative philosophy taught in the schools, namely Christian Aristotelianism, scholasticism. He wants a practical philosophy that knows the force and action of earth, air, fire, water, stars, and all the other bodies that surround us. Note the accent, force and action. These are new concepts in physics, really, introduced by Galileo and then Bacon and Descartes himself. And we know these, the force and action of bodies, he says, just as we know the various skills of our craftsmen, namely from the point of view of how to generate them. He said, by means of this knowledge, we can make ourselves, as it were, masters and possessors of nature. The first fruit of mastery of nature, he says, is an infinity of devices which will allow us to enjoy the fruits of the earth without labor, sans pain. Okay, technology. What's the second fruit? Medicine. All right. So all of science, the entire effort of scientific inquiry is bent on expanding human technological prowess. Now, this idea does not originate, I discovered, I learned from my own professors, especially Professor Richard Kennington, that this idea did not originate with Descartes. It originates really with Bacon.
Before we transition to Bacon, though the question I'm about to ask includes Bacon under its umbrella, but it just struck me as you were speaking about the insertion of the concept of force into the discussion of physics or physis, if you like, and how this perhaps, and you can tell me, you know, whether I'm off here, this sort of new way of framing things is involved in an explicit departure from Aristotelian physics, wherein the connection between the good or the highest good or concepts of the good broadly are actually connected with the concept of nature, if I'm tracking Aristotle correctly. So Galileo and friends, by using this sort of new vocabulary, are actually departing from classical physics.
Yes, that's exactly right. I mean, in book two of Aristotle's Physics, in the very first chapter, he defines physis, or nature, for you. And he said, nature is a principle of motion or of rest that's intrinsic to certain beings, you know. As opposed to artifice and convention, which come to be as a result of human choice or decision or power, you know. So, and he gives what to me is one of the best examples in the entire history of Western philosophy. He says, for example, if you were to bury a bed and the rotting wood were to sprout, what would sprout would be wood and not a bed. That's the difference between nature and convention, or nature and artifice, in a way. Okay, the accent falls on the intrinsic character of nature as a principle of motion or rest or growth or development. That ultimately reveals a certain, you know, the famous four causes, but especially what he calls the final cause, which is the end for the sake of which anything moves, which he also identifies as a good. Now, whether there is a the good, it remains a kind of aporia for Aristotle. He ends book 12 of the Metaphysics, indicating the necessity of a highest good, but the entire chapter is operatic. It's just a series of questions detailing prior opinion concerning whether there is a good, and if so, where it is, either in the world or in some sense beyond it. And he ends up not taking a position, interestingly. There remains a rather thriving debate about the nature of final causality in Aristotle. All that aside, the concept of an end is connected to a concept of a good. It, later on, I think it's in chapter 3 of the Physics, he says, why does so-and-so take a walk? He said, well, for the sake of health. Health is the end because it is the good for the sake of which so-and-so is taking a walk. And this applies to nature comprehensively. Aristotle states in De Anima, book 2, all beings, you know, all natural beings, animate and inanimate alike, and that's a hard case for him to demonstrate, but it's an act for the sake of some end. So final causality has this kind of hypothetical comprehensiveness, you know, for Aristotle. So why the animus against it at the beginning of modernity, you know? And I think it's a result of the way Christian theology appropriates that, because you know, very armed with Christian theology. If you look at that doctrine, it's pretty easy to say, oh, he's talking about God, you know, who is the end for the sake of which, you know, all created being lives and acts. God is therefore the highest good. Okay, well.
Now, let me ask you this question as well, because the notion of techne does receive some attention in Aristotle.
Oh, yeah, quite a bit, and actually.
It would it be perhaps salutary to contrast his framing of techne, which is, you know, craft or art, which then becomes taken up and transformed into the word technology or whatever. But our concept of technology is decidedly different from what I would say different from what he sketches, but that contrast might be fruitful. I don't know if you have anything to.
Yeah, for just basically, and this again arises in book two of the Physics, which is a really critical source, I think, for these questions in Aristotle. In what chapter is it? I think it's chapter 7 of book 2. I could be mistaken. He says, you know, techne both sharpens nature and brings to completion what nature leaves unfinished. So it, you know, it improves upon what's already given by nature. Okay. Think of herbal cures or something, or think of Hippocratic medicine in general, which takes its bearings from the same sort of conception. It's not an alternative to nature, it's meant to replace nature. He says suggestively, it completes what nature leaves unfinished. All right, so nature doesn't always complete its work. Sometimes its work is ongoing, especially in human things. Human nature tends to bifurcate. Human physiological development comes to completion around the age of 14 or 15 or 16 or something like that. But soul is never complete. This I'm speaking in an Aristotelian context, you know. In any event, so there's a kind of duality there. And that particular incompleteness of human soul is not something that can be solved, let's say, or completed by means of technology for Aristotle. It's only completed by the search for wisdom, finally, by leading the highest possible human life, actualizing our highest potential for rationality, which consists in philosophical inquiry and contemplation, finally, theoria. Okay, so what is that? So techne has a subordinate position to phusis for Aristotle, you know. This is a point, by the way, just in passing, that Heidegger discusses in earnest in a few different writings. He holds that really their meanings are mutually implicating, but that we'll set that aside for a moment. In a more orthodox understanding of Aristotle, the techne or human production is subordinate to what is by nature, because what is by nature is eternal. And what is as a result of human effort comes into being in time and will pass out of being in time and is wholly contingent upon us. In a way in which for nature or number or geometrical forms, any of the aidae, any of the so-called ideas or forms exist totally independently of us. Hence their superiority to us, you know, from the point of view of their eternity. When Aristotle refers to something as more divine, I think his use of the word divine is, well, for one thing, it's a kind of novelty in Greek, the way he uses it. I think only Plato uses it adjectivally in a way before him. But it connotes something that is eternal and unchanging. Techne, therefore, borrows its causality from observation of nature, and it employs the same kind of causality. It's just that the agent cause and the source of the formal cause and therefore the nature of the final cause depend on us. Nature doesn't build houses, we do. But in building a house, we use natural materials and bring them to a kind of completion for the sake of lodging, you know, in accordance with ideas that we generate for ourselves based on our own, the limitations of human nature.
Not actually wholly incommensurate with the subsequent modern account of technology.
Sure. Really, Descartes is the most, is, I think, the final nail in the coffin here, where clearly the things, you know, human production is clearly higher than human theory or contemplation. He makes it absolutely clear, with a clarity that is not even in Bacon, that the theoretical is totally subordinate to the practical and productive, you know? And for that reason, you need a particular political order to sustain the scientific technological progress. Descartes therefore points to what my teacher, Professor Kennington, used to refer to as a syncretic union between science and civil society. That has a very particular stratification, although Descartes never really spells it out much beyond what he says in part six of the discourse. He doesn't see himself as a political philosopher. He's quite emphatic about that in his correspondence with Hobbes, for example. In any event.
So this would probably be a point which to insert Bacon, however, right? Because
yes,
notion connects with what you see in.
Yeah.
The New Atlantis. And
yeah, the New Atlantis is the most emphatic statement of a society run by a scientific elite on behalf of, you know, I'm trying to think of the exact phrase, the expansion of human power beyond all limits, you know, and in fact, so, I mean, back in classical antiquity, nature, even for Lucretius, nature imposes a limit. The limit is mortality, the ultimate limit, you know, and that's not a limit that is that can be transgressed. In Bacon, the entire effort, or not the entire effort, I shouldn't say that, but the weight of the effort of the scientists on the island of Ben Salem, you know, which is the locus of the New Atlantis, is on medicine meant to indefinitely extend human life, down to attempting to revivify corpses, which they're storing in caves, towers, bodies of water. It's the place is littered with bodies, you know. In any event, it's almost funny, and Bacon's. The way Bacon writes about it, he writes about it with a combination of both optimism and skepticism. You know, he sees great peril in this endeavor, but also great promise. So you have that, and then you have in the New Atlantis the elevation of this notion of scientific progress to the status of a religion. But this is where the elitism of the island comes in. The scientific elite know the truth about what they're doing. Nobody outside the secretive House of Solomon, where all this research is taking place and all this invention is taking place, really understand what's going on in there. And so there's a bifurcation between the scientific elite and all the rest of the citizens who are content with that bifurcation. Precisely, and the secrecy of the house, precisely because they benefit so conspicuously from its efforts, you know? Hence the name of the island, Ben Salem. It is the child of peace, you know? But part of being the child of peace requires an adjustment of religion. Bacon is no believer in general enlightenment. You know, the many need something, and they need to believe something that will ultimately conduce to the scientific project, you know, of mastery of nature. And so Bacon in New Atlantis creates a religion that calls itself Christianity, which is really a highly vestigial Christianity. There's something like Christian charity, except it's really, and Christian hope, except the hope is in scientific progress and the charity is a result of the great beneficences technology can bring about. Nonetheless, there is this kind of mystery about the piety of the scientists, which, you know, so the popular piety itself is taken away from Christianity as it had been practiced. It's bleached of any sort of sectarianism. It involves symbols of non-Christian religions. It's that ecumenical in appearance. The scientists of the island apparently concoct a miraculous event, which convinces the people of the island at this point in their history, 2,000 years in, or about 1,000 years into their history, practicing a certain religious diversity. He says there were Jews, Muslims, or Jews, Persians, so Zoroastrians at that point, and Hindus on the island. And after this event, so just about everybody converts to Christianity, but it's this generic Christianity. Now, interestingly, it's necessary to compare that event in New Atlantis with the essay on religion that Bacon writes in his essays, which I'm going to read to you. It's the second, I believe, yes, the third essay in his collection of essays. It's called Of Unity in Religion. Now, of course, he's writing at a time of sectarian violence, as is Descartes, you know. And he writes, religion being the chief band of human society, it is a happy thing when itself is well contained within the true band of unity. The quarrels and divisions about religions were evils unknown to the heathen. So ancient religion, pagan religion, was not a religion that fostered sectarian violence. It turns out why? Because it didn't believe in anything. It wasn't a doctrine. It was a series of practices meant to reinforce a certain kind of civic identity, a point that Bacon gathers from Machiavelli. But then he continues, but the true God hath this attribute, that he is a jealous God, and therefore his worship and religion will endure no mixture nor partner. So the problem with Christianity is that it leads to sectarian violence. Why? Because it's doctrinal in character. And you can argue over doctrine, and that's how we've gotten into this mess, you know, from Bacon's point of view. The solution is science, in a way, science as the object of a new kind of religion that somewhat disguises itself in accordance with the old Christianity, but nonetheless sustained scientific effort. So in the New Atlantis, you have all the elements of what become the Enlightenment doctrine after Descartes, right? You have this coordination of science and civil society, where civil society is ruled by a scientific elite who themselves do not do anything in terms of politics. They don't take part in ruling at all. They simply practice science and develop technologies. So what really rules the island seems to be an idea, the idea of scientific progress, which requires a myth to sustain it, hence the new version of Christianity that develops. So in any event, the New Atlantis is a book everyone ought to read. It's really, there's a journal about science and technology out, you know, it's been around for decades, called the New Atlantis, in fact.
In many ways, it's a very bizarre text.
Oh, it is. I think, but, arguably, I think it's the first work of science fiction in the West, you know.
Another point you raised, because you had had me look at some essays that you had composed about the quality of the island, is how it also effaces the significance of the individual.
Oh yes, and, absolutely so.
And this is kind of ironic, in as far as that oftentimes modernity is said to be marked by heralding of the individual and their significance as a person and so on. However, it seems like the very category of the person is vacated for its significance on the New Atlantis.
This is a complex issue, and it develops in stages, beginning with Machiavelli, you know, this what becomes the modern emphasis on individualism. In a way, that is indeed at work in Bacon, but in a less evident way than it is in Machiavelli and others. Machiavelli's root assumption in The Prince and in the Discourses, it's especially clear in The Prince, is that human beings are by nature acquisitive. That is the one thing you can say of all human beings. They desire more, you know. In a way, you know, he's riffing on, you know, on Thucydides and Herodotus, who indicate, you know, that the cause of war is pleonexia, the desire to have war, the desire to have more. In any event, And it's the this desire is so potent, desire for acquisition is so potent that praise and blame migrate from notions of right and wrong action to successful and unsuccessful acquisition, you know. So he says, what's praiseworthy, you know, if you set out to acquire and you're successful, you will be always praised. But if you set out to acquire and you fail, you are always going to be blamed. So praise and blame get disconnected from notions of classical virtue, which is part of a general revision of the concept of virtue in Machiavelli, which we can talk about. In any event, if that's the root assumption, that immediately divides human beings. So human nature, owing to its essentially acquisitiveness, is dissociative. Nature dissociates. Hobbes, you know, a generation later, makes that, he states that baldly again. Nature dissociates human beings. The exact converse of classical political philosophy, where by nature human beings seek community on really fundamental levels, the most fundamental level being friendship. That appears nowhere in Machiavelli, nowhere in Bacon, nowhere in Descartes. Okay, the root assumption is of nature's dissociativeness. So really, on the one hand, we are just a conglomeration, a civil society is a conglomeration of individuals with competing individual interests. So modern individualism has its roots not in an exploration of the depths of human soul or striving or something like that. It's a kind of reductionism. In fact, Machiavelli never mentions the word soul anywhere, okay, in The Prince. It doesn't show up once, unless I'm mistaken. Individualism is rooted just in self-interest. And he makes certain general assumptions about that self-interest, which also have a basis, however, in classical political thought, in Book Three of Aristotle's Politics and in Marsilius of Padua, for example, that there are really two fundamental humors, he says, in every society. One is the humors of the great who seek to oppress, and the humors of the many who seek not to be oppressed. You know, this looks back to the distinction both Plato and Aristotle draw between fundamental tensions between democratic and oligarchic natures in political life, and how every all civil strife really presents from that kind of tension. For Plato and Aristotle, that's where virtue comes in. You have to educate people in such a way that they find a common good. Machiavelli thinks that's simply impossible. There is no common good except your own gratification. So you've got to arrange a political system that that can manage collective antagonisms in such a way that the regime isn't destroyed. And that's, you know, much of The Prince and the discourses are about that. Bacon accepts that argument. Basically, you know, as far as I can tell, pretty much wholesale, except what's going to unify society. There is a way of unifying society, but not through moral virtue or improvement of human character, which is you know, a lost cause. He's persuaded that Machiavelli is right in that, but rather through a fundamentally shared interest that will speak to our native acquisitiveness and, you know, hence modern natural science for the sake of generating technologies that will gratify that interest. So once again, you have a doctrine of self-interest undergirding a society that, you know, he parodies in The New Atlantis, which requires a maximum identification with the common good so that nothing interferes with scientific progress. So it's this weird blend of the anonymity of citizens, on the one hand, with self-interest being the engine that will compel human beings, compel individuals to accept that anonymity. I mean, you see this really come to a head in Hobbes and Leviathan, and also in Spinoza's Theological Political Tractatus. You know, where the principal virtue of citizens is to be completely innocuous, basically, you know. That goes back to Machiavelli saying the many just want to be left alone. They want to be left alone to acquire and enjoy their lives. They don't want to be messed with.
Well, I mean, there's a superficial truth to that characterization, but it seems that they're misunderstanding that I think most people are bothered by the notion of imposition from exterior institutions,
well, training, that's why,
and so on, but right. not, I don't know. I think that it's a mischaracterization of that aversion to then say that they should simply be encouraged towards docility.
They will encourage themselves to docility by virtue of being satisfied. You know, that the what encourages the Romagna in, I think it's chapter 7 or 8 of The Prince, into an acceptance of Cesare Borgia's rule is the murder of a henchman of Cesare Borgia by Cesare Borgia, which leaves the people, he says, stupefied and satisfied. That's the New Atlantis. They're stupefied by the spectacle that brings about their new religion, and they're satisfied. So what's there to complain about, you know? Providing that there are no theoretical provocations to strife, namely no religious doctrines to fight over. The only thing that is compelling citizens is the desire to keep this thing moving, keep Ben Salem together, keep it progressing, so that everyone can enjoy the benefit. I agree in this respect. You know, Bacon's got an extraordinarily low view of human beings. He thinks we're willing to really relinquish our freedom and individual choice for the sake of gratification. You know, I think many of the problems of modernity, the unbridled character of technological expansion, can be rooted in the general acceptance of that thesis about human beings. You see this both in Marxist-Leninism on the one hand and in capitalism on the other. That's what makes me, by the way, focus on these early thinkers. Everything in modernity, to me, develops out of them. I mean, and a couple others, but especially these three. They lay the foundation, so to speak.
I mean, there's a remarkable pessimism. And the manner in which they tend to sort of cast what it is to be human, and the primacy they give to the category of satisfaction, which is interesting in that Aristotle, by contrast, I won't use the word satisfaction. You might look at something like fulfillment, but that fulfillment is attained through a life of contemplation.
Ultimately.
But that has a very different sort of qualitative feel, if you like, to it than the notion of mere satisfaction, which is going to entangle you constantly.
Well, there has to be, what characterizes the modern concept of satisfaction is its materiality. It's material satisfaction. There's no higher satisfaction. Some handful of people might think there is, but they can go off and try to pursue it, but they're going to get nowhere. See, I think maybe, but part of the reason that you see this reductionism in Machiavelli, and the reason it's persuasive for all these authors in the next, couple of centuries, is a result of the perceived failure of Christianity to actually make human life better. And instead, it's led to war and conflict and poverty. Now, I'm speaking from their point of view and saying these things. Right. You're neglecting everything else about them. You're focusing only on the political instantiations of Christianity. Descartes, in the Discourse on Method, refers twice to political issues with regard to Christianity. The first is the 30 Years' War. At the beginning of part two and the end of part three of the discourse, he refers to that. At the beginning of part two, he said, "I was then in Germany where the wars which are still continuing led me." Okay, the 30 Years' War, that wasn't a war between Christians and Jews or Christians and Muslims. That was a war within, between Christians. that suggests a certain failure to act upon, the teaching of the gospel. And then, of course, the second thing he draws attention to is the trial of Galileo. In part one of the discourse, in his discussion of, he says, the moral writings of the ancient pagans, and this explains why how Plato and Aristotle got dragged into this rejection with Christianity. He says, they aim too high. They're like proud and magnificent palaces built on a foundation of sand and mud. You know, he goes on to say, and often what they call by so fine sounding a name is nothing more than insensibility, pride, despair, or parricide. There are four cardinal virtues that were, you know, are passed down in the tradition in the Middle Ages. He names four alternative names for those things. He's inviting you to consider that what we have considered virtue aims so high that striving for it will actually deform your soul, you know? That's a powerful, powerful indictment. That's as powerful as anything I know in Machiavelli, more powerful than anything I've read in Bacon. And that's from Descartes. So, you know, I was just talking about classical antiquity then, but, you know, that extends to Christianity. Christianity has, and this is where Machiavelli helps with this, you know, Christianity either overshoots the mark or undershoots the mark. It's capable of what he calls pious cruelty, excessive violence that wipes out entire peoples. For example, the example he points to in The Prince is Ferdinand of Aragon. Aragon, who he refers to as Ferdinand the Catholic, which is an interesting way to refer to him. That wasn't common. He wants you to keep in mind that this guy was a Catholic and practiced what he called pious cruelties in the expulsion of the Marranos from Spain, for example.
But Machiavelli's treatment of Christianity is more elaborate than just and I think it, for example, you know, you were telling me the other day about how he characterizes the Franciscans and how. And so there's a few moments in his treatment of Christianity vis-a-vis its implications for the Roman Empire. And that analysis then transposes into, well, that transposes isn't the right word though, but it contributes significantly to how he conceives his own positive notion of the political. So could you explicate that, those terms?
Sure, yeah. He makes the claim in the preface to his discourses on Livy that the ancient order, modes and orders have fallen into oblivion, and he blames Christianity for that. Okay, so what he's going to try to do, presumably by reaffirming and reinterpreting Livy for us, is to restore some sense of what those ancient modes and orders were. So as he, right off the bat, his project is in tension with Christianity. And so he speaks about Christianity, religion in general, and Christianity in particular, in three waves. The first one in book one contrasts with Roman religion. Roman religion, you know, this is what Bacon picks up on, is really ritual. It's civil religion. It's entirely. It's simply for the sake of holding the community together. And it only works because people believe it. They believed it because Numa Pompilius, who introduced religion into Rome, according to Machiavelli's reading of Livy, convinced the people he slept with a nymph and therefore spoke with divine authority. Now, this is kind of a joke, you know, but it turns out, as a few chapters later, he indicates the upper strata of civil society don't believe this stuff for a minute, but they're going to go down the street and offer sacrifices to, you know, Jupiter whenever necessary. Not because they believe it, but because they have to keep up the appearance of belief in order to establish a common political religious identity. It's sort of the same thing that goes on in Plato's Apology, right? And with Socrates, you know, Socrates is accused of, he says, ude theos nomitze, you know, not believing in the legal gods, you know, the gods of the city. And so there's this mixture of religious tradition and ancestral, and that's Roman religion. That has kept Rome strong because people buy into this. He said, but on the other hand, he said, in our church, in the Roman Church, he means the Roman Catholic Church, he was writing all this a year or two prior to the Reformation, interestingly. He says, you know, that really the people lose their faith the closer they are to the center. He means once you see how the popes and the cardinals actually live, you lose your faith entirely. And that's the problem. So our religion fails to establish the kind of unity and shared identity that the Roman religion seemed to be able to establish. That's phase one. Phase two is what our religion has taught. He says, in contrast to, he said, the rituals of the Roman religion were filled with, you know, ferocious and sanguinary spectacles that helped inspire love of country and therefore defense of freedom in the citizens. He says, but our religion, he said, the extols contemplative rather than active men, he says, and the rituals are rather banal, and he said they weaken and effeminate citizens. He said if they teach you to be strong in anything, it's how to take a beating. Okay, and but he insinuates at that point is this somehow runs counter to the original conception of Christianity. But he didn't comment further on it then, any more about that. So there seems to be a contrast between Christianity as it has developed in the Roman Church into the 16th century, you know, into Machiavelli's age, and what it was originally. And the insinuation is, originally it was more muscular than it is today, you know. Now comes the third and most striking criticism. He talks about the renewal of religion in regimes. And he said, our religion would have totally disappeared were it not for the Franciscan and Dominican renewals, because he said, living lives of poverty, which they shared with the people to whom they preached and having credit with them, he says, in sermons and confessions. He said, this renewal taught people not to speak evil of evil. You know, okay, so the first criticism, the church is committing evil. The third criticism is, and we were taught not to notice it or not to speak of it when we saw it by these Franciscans and Dominicans who have managed, in short, to preserve the weakness of the contemporary Christian who won't speak out against the abuses of the church. And he says, you know, in this way, the ordinary citizens were left, ordinary believers were left to the whim of those who didn't fear punishment that they did not see and did not believe. He's talking about the clerics. So basically, he draws this picture of the Roman Church as suffering from the abuses of ecclesiastical power so profound that... But also successful because of the actual teaching of the church, which has weakened most believers, and so that they're willing to acquiesce to it. By contrast, he says, this is not what it was. What was it originally? He only lets on in really a couple chapters later on in book three, where he talks about people being displaced from their homelands. And he insinuates very strongly, this is what Christianity used to be like. It used to flood a country and get rid of everything every vestige of paganism. So here's the issue in Machiavelli. It's a rather complicated one. And in Bacon's New Atlantis is an attempt to solve it, you know. Namely, Christianity, on the one hand, has weakened civil bonds and especially love of freedom, you know, love of republican government, you know, in the original sense. On the other hand, it was also capable of extraordinary violence, you know, such that it wiped out any vestige of Roman paganism or any kind of paganism in the countries that it managed to convert. Christianity.
So remarkable the bitterness of Machiavelli's analysis. It's cynicism just leaves me really astounded.
He's watched the church, destroy any vestiges of unity in Italy by siding alternatively with the Austrians and the French, you know, against the Italians themselves. That's a large part of it. But what's interesting is that his observations aren't, let's say, merely political. He tries to get to the theoretical core of why this happens, you know, and it happened. That's what, you know, you'd have to read the entirety of The Prince and the discourses to get to that. But this is not, by the way, the center of Machiavelli's teaching. The center of his teaching has to do with fortune and power, virtù, you know.
I think it's nonetheless quite significant because his appeal to fortune and power, I think, is intimately related to the cynicism. What strikes me is his blind spot and his inability to understand the success of the Christian project. As problematic as that success may have been, simply in terms of extinguishing pagan hegemony vis-a-vis violence. He seems to have no grasp of the possibility that early Christianity might have represented a radically different vision of human relationship.
It might have done, you know, but from his point of view, that was quickly swallowed up by its imperial ambitions after Constantine. So we have a new thing going by the second century.
That is true, but I think that the reason that happened was because it was initially radically subversive of certain cultural relational values, and that then it became necessary for it to be appropriated and domesticated, so-called Constantinian Christianity. That being said, I don't want to become detained by this tangent because, as you know, this is not the center of Machiavelli. The center of Machiavelli is this alternative appeal to a doctrine of virtue and fortune, or virtù and fortuna. And perhaps now would be a neat point at which to sort of lay that out.
Yeah, let me just add one thing to the general discussion of religion. Why is this an issue at all for Machiavelli? Because he thinks that religion is necessary in regimes. He's just trying to find a civil religion on the basis of Christianity, the prevailing one, that will not preserve what he thinks is problematic about Christianity. That's where Bacon's taking his bearings from. Machiavelli doesn't answer that question, but religion is central to the political project. The political project is, I'm pausing for a moment. You know, as I mentioned earlier, it has to do with harnessing the diverse humors that result from human acquisitiveness, you know, on the premise that you can't educate them. The premise is that there is no highest good, you know, in light of which we can conform our behavior. That was the old notion of virtue, you know, human excellence in Aristotle and Plato and Cicero and elsewhere, such that an education that would develop virtue or excellence, arete, you know, would allow for the best possible regime to see the light of day. So the regimes should dedicate themselves to that sort of education. Well, for Machiavelli, it's a different story, since human beings can't be made good, they'd be owing to their native acquisitiveness. But their practice of acquisitiveness is subject, you know, largely to chance. Although once certain chance events arise, certain necessary rules take over. And that much of all the historical examples, all the attention to particulars in Machiavelli, and subsequently in Bacon and Descartes and modern natural science, really, an attempt to grasp those laws that end up governing human behavior under certain very specific conditions, you know, so that once something happens, you can figure out the chain of events, the necessary chain of events will evolve from that. Okay. So chance and necessity, rather than a highest good, rule not simply human affairs, but the entire cosmos, you know, and this is his Lucretianism, or his Lucretian inheritance, Machiavelli's. There's an inevitable change in cyclic change in regimes from a collective to a kind of patriarchy to monarchy, which devolves inevitably into dictatorship, which devolves into oligarchy, which or aristocracy, which devolves into oligarchies, which devolves into democracy, which devolves into anarchy, which requires a tyranny again to get the thing in order. And so you have this, there's no progress in history. There's this cycling through regimes. So how do you preserve a regime in perpetuity, you know, or as long as possible against the vicissitudes of chance and necessity? And the answer is through virtu. Now, so using the same word Aristotle does and Aquinas does, right, virtue, but it means something different. And as you see him transform the meaning of the word virtue throughout the Prince, he suggests when he first uses it, a sense that's not alien from Platonic Aristotelianism, but by the time you get to the end of the book, it's totally alien to it. Virtu means power, period. Or a particular combination, I should say, of power and foresight, prudence. He details examples of people who had supreme power, but were failures ultimately because of their lack of foresight or prudential judgment, or those who had for prudential judgment, but lacked the requisite power to act upon it, or were unwilling to act upon it, you know. So there's a balance of power and foresight meant to what? He says, harness fortuna, fortune. If there is no God, let me back off of it. If there is no highest good, if there's no abiding natural or supernatural order, then really fortune rules. And so the only thing that we can do as human beings is to try to harness it, master it. He compares fortune to a river that overflows its banks, floods everything in its sight. He says, unless it is diked by suitable virtue. So virtue is what controls fortuna. Virtu is on behalf of the mastery of fortuna. Mastery of fortuna is the goal of the political life, rightly understood. And that's what the astute prince has to understand. And he gives you many ways of thinking about that. The old way of thinking about virtue and the distinction between virtue and vice, he undermines from chapter 15 to the end of the book, or to the penultimate chapter of the book, by indicating, for example, by giving you pairs of virtues and vices and indicating that really the vice is usually the preferred, you know, because he substitutes expediency rather than the good as the measure in accordance with which people ought to be making their judgments. He too has a rather low view of the many. He says the vulgar are always persuaded by the appearance and the outcome of a thing, period, you know. So he's teaching princes how to manipulate appearances. He says at one point, rather strikingly, it's necessary for a prince to at times to act against religion, against mercy, against various other nice things. I can't recall the passage. He said, but then, you know, one paragraph later, he said, at the same time, it's necessary for the prince to appear to be all virtue, all religion, all piety, all charity. So part of the acquisition of virtu is to know how to exercise it in ways that are fitting for the circumstances in order to keep the many in thrall, you know. In any event, that's a very, very swift shaping of the connection between virtu and fortuna. The main thing is that fortuna or chance defines human affairs. Human affairs are simply fortuitous all the time. And there's no rational order that we can latch onto that will help affect some sort of orderliness or predictability. But that's the goal. Human power makes the world predictable. Flash ahead to Bacon and Descartes. That's the goal of modern natural science, to make the world predictable by importing concepts of law, laws of nature, where before there was no such concept. What do laws of nature determine? The force and action of bodies whose motions are basically random, but we can study how things move. We can force the motion of bodies into regular predictable patterns and therefore make ourselves masters and possessors of nature. The political problem is solved through the development of scientific technology based on a particular set of concepts meant to replace the ancient doctrine of final causality. Now, forgive me for blathering on here, but no, that's the motion of
I think what's striking is that there is a qualitative shift which occurs with Bacon from Machiavelli. As monstrous as Machiavelli's account is, somehow, as I hear you summarize it, there is persisting an actual human element in its vision. Mm-hmm. Whereas with Bacon and then Descartes, it strikes me that they appropriate the political account of Machiavelli, but that account then becomes subordinate to a specifically scientific and technical enterprise, which then in turn effectively extinguishes the human, even the human which still lives within Machiavelli.
Yeah, I'm two things. First of all, I don't know that the political account of Machiavelli is subordinate to the scientific account. I would rather say the opposite. I think the scientific account is born from a way of trying to assimilate Machiavelli's political conclusions. I mean, Bacon reading Machiavelli, which we know he did. You know, he praises Machiavelli in several places and paraphrases him several places in the essays. Just looks at that, the conclusion of the prince and mastery over fortuna. He said, well, fortuna, that's just nothing but nature. So mastery of nature will solve the political problem, but mastery of nature is only solved by means of knowledge of nature. That's physics. So physics will provide the solution to the scientific problem. So there isn't a subordination right off the bat of the political to the scientific endeavor as if the scientific endeavor preceded it. There's an attempt to meld the scientific and the political. So the political judgment guides the way in which early modern natural science understands the nature of nature, why they move away from the Aristotelian concept of final causality that had governed, 20 centuries of physics to this new thing, law, force, action. And so, Bacon, by the way, quite explicit.
Right. Scientia propter potentia, right?
Or something. Yeah. Like
I guess I'm being kind of Illulean in my construal, and it may just be a slight sort of semantic tension in that, whereas initially the idea is that you can use science as a tool to realize certain political ends.
Yeah.
And it may well be that the account of nature implicit in Machiavelli's political scheme is the ground of how science then unfolds. What ends up happening is that the science redounds upon the executors of the project and extinguishes the basis of genuine political life. Its very nature. For Elul, it's really the technological as opposed to the scientific, which does this, right? The technological ends up effacing the human because it's structurally so mindlessly consuming. There's no end to it. And I suppose that's why I'm inclined to say that ultimately the political becomes subordinate to the scientific. But really, it's kind of a chicken and egg sort of problem. But maybe I'm just off in my reading there. Go on.
I'm really focusing on the first moment of that. What you say about Elul's reflection on the contemporary situation with technology, I find agreeable in a way. I mean, in the evening, I sit with my dogs on my front porch. I watch people walk down the street. Every single bloody one is with their phone. You know, it's a beautiful evening. The birds are chirping. You can hear owls in Null Park Woods. And nonetheless, everybody's got their phone out. You know, I think that's a kind of silly, but, you know, nonetheless, frequently observable example of what you're talking about. Technology is easily, it's easy to succumb to it, to be willingly deadened by it, at which point Bacon apparently is right, isn't he? You know? So that, I mean, that's the kind, what Alul is observing is what Bacon proposes would happen in a regime that exists for the sake of science and technology. Especially, you were saying the sort of endlessness of this. That reminds me of a passage in two passages in the New Atlantis. The first time we're told about the House of Solomon, we're told by a man who identifies himself as a Christian priest. He says, the end of the house, the purpose of the house is the study of the works and creatures of God. Okay, that's what he says. All right. Once you get into the house, the scientist father within the house tells the visitor, the end of our house is knowledge of the secret motions of things, for the enlarging of the bonds of human empire and the effecting of all things possible. And say all things good. At least, you know, Descartes wants to constrain the possible with some concept of the good. Where it comes from is another issue. But perhaps from a kind of enlightened self-interest. You can see where, you know, Locke and Hobbes arise in a way in order to solve that question with various kinds of provisional moral restraints. But it's really striking to me in Bacon to affect all things possible. So there is a kind of open-endedness. This is what Swift sends up, by the way, in Gulliver's Travel, you know, the island of the crazy scientists, you know, who live utterly detached from everybody else.
That is actually almost explicitly Alulian, in that for Alul, the ethics of technology are the ethics of the if it is possible, then it must be made actual.
Yeah, exactly. That seems the logic here.
So there's definitely overlap there. So.
You know, I have a perfect example of this. I think it was back in 2000 or 2001, Dr. Ian Wilmot, the creator of or father of Dolly, the sheep, the first cloned higher mammal, came, you know, he went on the lecture circuit and he came to Xavier of all places.
I actually recall that.
I think you might. Yeah, but and you know, he explained the processes of cloning and all that. He explained the science behind it. He admitted a couple things that I think are really telling and really very consonant with Bacon and Descartes. The first thing he admitted is they didn't really understand the underlying science. They just knew that if they put these things together, they'd get a certain kind of effect. And it was the effect they were interested in, not the underlying science. All they needed are useful hypotheses that'll get them where they want, to the product they wanted. The other thing is during the question and answers, I recall a number of Xavier students kept on peppering him with questions about the ethical implications of cloning higher mammals. And his response was the same all the time. Basically that he said, I'm not interested in these ethical questions. I'm a scientist. Well, that's a really shocking, you know, and perfectly Baconian sort of admission, you know? At the same time though, he said, these technologies are going to be useful for farming, pharming, namely pharmaceutical farming, you know, where you develop sheep without a resistance factor for insulin and things like that, you know, and for transplants and things. So, but that somehow didn't depend or require any sort of ethical oversight, you know. It was a shocking statement to me. It still strikes me as utterly emblematic of modern natural science and technology on the one hand, and what's so deeply problematic about the whole thing. This is what sent me back into this project, trying to find the roots of this.
I've encountered similar things where it's befuddling the notion that you could just so tidily compartmentalize scientific project from the implications, technological implications.
Right.
It may actually bring us back to the question of the political, because as you say, there's a political project in Machiavelli.
And in Bacon and in Descartes.
And so what is the contrasting account? Like that is the, I guess I get a sense that their conception of the political becomes dominant in much of what unfolds in contemporary political history. You can even look at the French Revolution. My sympathy with the French Revolution notwithstanding, in many ways, you even have an appeal to a new civic religion there, right? Which is very, very redolent of the sorts of things which Bacon in particular was suggesting. But if that, so if that is the dominant political account, what is the alternative? How are we to reconceive the political to escape from this impasse to which, or in which we find ourselves at the moment?
I think it requires a major conceptual shift, no longer taking for granted the ultimacy of modern natural science and its categories and its way of conceiving nature, but by re-examining the very concept of nature that modern natural science excludes, and therefore re-evaluating the relation between theory and practice, so to speak, or theoria and the theoretical, the contemplative lives, in order to re-establish some sort of proper relationship to the natural world. As I'm speaking on the level of education, in terms of political systems, I don't know what that would look like exactly. There might be ways of rehabilitating a genuine kind of an original kind of republicanism of the sort you get in Plato and Aristotle. You know, I think that would be extraordinarily difficult. I mean, technology has become part of the furniture we have to live with, and you know, we also have to be careful, because as much as problematic as it is, last summer when I almost died, I was really in favor of all the technology they could muster to be alive. You know, bring it on! I need more things. You know. I think it's a question of I think the problem has to do with understanding the limits of the technological. This question is finally surfacing in earnest in a public way with the AI debate. It seems to me that as a replacement for human intelligence, it's extraordinarily dangerous. If it is meant to sharpen human intelligence or extend it a bit, as long as it's subordinate to the human and therefore subordinate to moral inspection, then technology isn't intrinsically bad. It's intrinsically neutral. It's always neutral to the uses toward which it's put. If that's the case, I mean, and that's been one of the deep problems with the development of contemporary medicine. The more technologized it has gotten, the more an ethic intrinsic to medical practice is maintained. If you look at, you contrast the original forms of the Hippocratic Oath in antiquity with the contemporary form, contemporary version of the Hippocratic Oath could work for car mechanics just as well as it can work with doctors. There's no ethic intrinsic to the treatment of human bodies as there is in this more ancient conception. Part of that ancient conception is restored by having a healthy respect for human mortality. That, you know, modern medicine in a way begins conceptually with Descartes and Bacon's attempt to treat death as a disease and cure it. Maybe it's not a disease after all. Maybe there's something that can be said for mortality. I'm not looking forward to it, by the way, but as I rapidly approach it, you know. But on the other hand, it might be embracing mortality is what would have to accompany a revelation of something approaching an ancient conception of nature and the natural. You know, we have to see ourselves as morally responsible beings, but not the ultimate being. So there's a wonderful remark in Aristotle's Ethics in Book 6, one of the later chapters, where he writes, it's absurd to think that ethics are political science or the highest sciences, because man is not the greatest thing in the universe. The universe itself is greater. We die, it doesn't, you know. It seems necessary to reintroduce a sense of humility with regard to human effort, which I think follows from the preservation of elevation of the contemplative over the practical. We got to be content with a slower rate of scientific and technological progress for the sake of a more humane assimilation of that progress, I think.
I would be inclined to go further than that, because I personally am no longer persuaded that technology is merely instrumental. Mm-hmm. This is, that is, in fact, as I recall, even an Aristotelian characterization, but then others, ironically Heidegger, for example, but others have noted that this may be something of an error, that a technology actually has implicit within it a perspective extending beyond a particular technology. And so mm-hmm. I think an extraordinary caution is incumbent upon the manufacture of any tool, because in the tool there is a vision. A tool is part of an assemblage. It never can exist in isolation.
Right.
It's part of a whole web of relationships that suggest a specific sort of anthropology. And when we look at contemporary medical technologies, pharmaceuticals and devices and so forth, they seem to me connected to a particular account of the human being that is deeply problematic. Which, well, of course, probably circles back to what you were just saying about the need for an assertion of humility and how we have to enter into a renewed relationship with our mortality and so forth.
No, I actually agree with what you were just saying. The whole anthropology has shifted in such a way as to make virtually effaced the ancient and even the Christian medieval possibilities, and therefore any kind of restriction on the spread of technology, especially medical technologies. Once you don't see nature as a principle anymore, once you dispense with that and dispense with the ultimacy of natural kinds, which is what Bacon does and mathematization of nature and Descartes follows through on, then you can endlessly manipulate nature. The great terror of our age is that the masters of nature have now set about mastering themselves, but beyond that is a complete misconception, I think, of the nature of nature and the ultimacy of nature. We can, it's like Horace said, you can throw it out with a pitchfork, but it's going to come back in through the door. And how is it going to come back in through the door? Well, through, I think, certain kinds of catastrophic events that, we've seen unfold in this century,
Also, I feel like for people who really take it seriously, it's going to disfigure their own subjectivity. I think it's incommensurate with human happiness to pursue your life in a way which suggests that you're just an assemblage,
right?
Parts, which there are sort of cultural expressions of that alternative perspective afoot even currently.
Oh yeah, so, yeah. I think there always have been. I mean, I think you can throw humanity out with a pitchfork; it's going to come back in through the door somehow, but often in rather perverse ways. Owing to the ultimacy of what's naturally human. That's why study has to precede practice. We have to really reconsider what it is to be a natural human being. Sadly, the discipline that does that is philosophy, and it's getting, thrown out with a pitchfork from universities left and right, at least in the United States, which is it's not just troubling, it's dangerous. We're educating a generation of technicians without any knowledge of what it is they're or why it is they're doing the things they're doing, except for some vague notion of advancing scientific progress or something like that. We praise the productive student, the student who doesn't have leisure to think, We praise the productive academic who publishes articles and goes to conferences and is busy with things, as opposed to the, you know, the two things the life of the mind really needs: leisure, you know, time, and humility. Modern university, modern culture in general denigrates those conditions, without which philosophy and I think a complete human life are simply impossible.
Well, you know, philosophy, like the theater, is always dying, right?
Yeah, but, it's true.
But you never can quite kill it. So I actually retain a fundamental optimism in the face of what I think are really rather challenging times. I don't think we face an ultimately existential threat, but I think that it is a incumbent upon us to resist the tide of contemporary culture, to minimize the suffering of immediately future generations.
Yeah, I agree. Absolutely agree. That's well put.
Well, thank you. I think we should probably wrap it up here. We've been going for a bit.
Well, I hope this was useful to you.
I think it is very useful to sort of really look at Machiavelli as a linchpin figure, and then Bacon and Descartes.
Yeah.
Though Descartes, it's not uncommon to find people who appreciate the manner in which Descartes is problematic, but with Bacon and Machiavelli, their contributions, I don't think, are as widely recognized. And especially Machiavelli, in that he's often treated as just sort of a throwaway figure who wrote this one little book, The Prince, and he's kind of interesting. But the fact is that his vision informs the modern project in a way that is not trivial.
Everybody read him.
So
Benjamin Franklin was so enamored of Machiavelli, he learned Italian so he could read him in the original. All the founders read him and took him very seriously because the people they read Machiavelli and took him seriously. Hobbes and Locke, you know, and Rousseau. Rousseau coins the term civil religion. He's reflecting on Machiavelli's account in the Discourses and the Prince. In fact, Rousseau has much to say about the Prince. That's quite interesting. All these people, really do recognize Machiavelli as their starting point. That's why, you know, it's important not to just treat Machiavelli as a naive political realist or something like that. He's trying to introduce, as he puts, new modes and orders, an entirely new framework, an entirely new horizon. He's a philosopher. He's trying to offer an alternative.
That actually connects with a somewhat different but also real issue of our time, and it's the issue of cultural literacy, right?
Yeah.
And being grounded as a historical entity in a deeper, longer conversation. So we've become so displaced from the tradition, you know, and of course there isn't the tradition, there's a polyphony of voices there, but they're connected.
Yeah.
And you have to have a relationship, and it takes time, by the way, to read and get through to all, and you can never access all of it, right? Okay. But the fact that we are prone to these gaping lacunae, these oversights, these misreadings is, I think, a effect of the digital time in which we find ourselves, and we just need to get back to actually reading the books.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. One thing one discovers, if you've been educated in a kind of great books format, is that they all don't agree with each other at all. You enter into a conversation with minds greater than yours, that's how you become humble. And then you realize their disagreements, and so you're able to move into a conversation with them. That's the starting point for us culturally. And as you say, it's been virtually effaced in university curricula, but also by the digital propensities of the contemporary age, even in universities.
I could go on, but I'm gonna stop myself from going on, right? So
yeah.
like the digital and, but anyway, thank you. So
thank you, Tom. My pleasure.
I'll talk to you soon.
And,
catch you guys in the flip. Ciao for now.
Bye-bye.